Welcome back to PaleoCast. This is part two of our three-part series covering the 75th anniversary meeting of SVP, and this is covering the scientific content of the meeting, so I hope you enjoy.
Justin Wilkins. I'm the in-situ curator and secondary educator at the Mammoth Site of Hot Springs, South Dakota.
Could you tell me a little bit about the history of the site?
Yeah, the Mammoth Site was discovered in 1974 when a landowner was tearing down a hill for his land development, going to turn that into housing, came across some bones, specifically some ribs and teeth that he didn't know what they were at the time, but one of the bulldozer operators that he had hired, his son had actually seen these kind of things before. So that bulldozer son's operator went and contacted his professor and told him about it, and that was Dr. Larry Agenbrod. Dr. Agenbrod then basically, to make a very long story short, had been the site director for the last 40 years, up until very recently when he passed away.
And can you tell me a bit about the site itself?
Right. So at the Mammoth Site in Hot Springs, we're basically a sinkhole site, so we've got a sinkhole that formed in the limestone of the Black Hill and then fell out. It was a big cave that collapsed, fell out and made a pond, which was fairly attractive to mammoths. And what we found is that we have, right now, our minimum number is 61 animals. So it could wind up being a lot more. And everything we found that we can determine gender for has been male. So that's pretty awesome.
So why do you think that would be? Why would you find males and not females?
Well, the way elephant family systems work is it's predominantly dominated by the females. There's usually one bull in the herd, maybe a satellite bull hanging out somewhere nearby. But generally speaking, it's grandma that runs the herd. It's a matriarchal system. And so when the young adult males start coming into their hormonal stages, they get fairly aggressive with the females in the group. And they're kind of rowdy, and the big bull doesn't like him either. So it's kind of a group decision to get rid of the young males. So they're left on their own, and just like some other species, young adolescent males are fairly stupid in elephants, or at least they don't make good decisions all the time. So our sinkhole's fairly steep-sided, between 45 and 60 degrees, depending on where you're at. In some cases, it's even 90 or over 90, but animals that get in here can't really climb out since it's a clay side that gets fairly wet and slippery when an animal slips in there. So the elephants get trapped.
Okay. Do you only find mammoths in the sinkhole?
Absolutely not. We've got over 86 other species of animals in the sinkhole, including we have camelops and giant short-faced bear, which is probably my favorite animal in the sinkhole. But we also have gray wolf, badgers, and fish, even. So what look like large minnows. But that's pretty interesting. And we get a lot of snails and clams and even feathers in the sinkhole.
And so most of the bones that you've discovered at the sinkhole are left in situ.
Right. So we excavate not year-round, but every year. And we do leave anything that we find in place unless we're worried about it falling out. Okay. So we will take things out periodically, but those are going to be conservation concerns. Or if we're really, really concerned about the research value of the specimen, for instance, our giant short-faced bear skull is not left in situ.
And can you tell me a bit about the research that's going on at the site right now?
So right now, we're kind of expanding out from the Mammoth Site specifically. We've done primarily Mammoth Site work for the past 40 years. And compared to other mammoth localities, now we're exploring generally more Ice Age material. For instance, our new site director, Jim Mead, he's leading cooperation between us and Wind Cave on a cave very near to Wind Cave called Persistence Cave. And from that, we're getting a lot of other animals. They've gotten camelops like we have, but they've also gotten what appears to be peccary and a whole slew of snakes and bats. So number of bones, over a few thousand bones already out of that cave.
Cool. And if people wanted to come to the mammoth site to visit it, it's open for visitors, is that right?
Yep, year round. Our hours reduce a little bit in the winter. We're not usually open past 3:30 in the winter, but we are open all but 8 days of the year.
Hi, my name is Mateusz Wojcik. I am a student at the University of Toronto studying my PhD with David Evans. Currently here at SVP, I am presenting a poster on the ontogenic long bone histology of Edmontosaurus annectans. Previous research suggests that you can use cyclical growth within Edmontosaurus to be able to clue in on possible migratory or overwintering patterns. Within my poster, we are showing that this may not be the case, and it may actually just be a form of sampling bias, being that within the previous research, it was just used juvenile material, and the older material was heavily secondary remodeled, not showing the zonal the zonation within the bone, whereas within ours, we have this huge wide variation in the ontogenic stages.
I'm Ryan Haupt. I am a graduate student getting my PhD at the University of Wyoming and a podcaster doing science, sort of. My poster this year at SVP is about analyzing a couple different fossil sites in Panama to see if one of the sites might have been a crocodilian hatchery or juvenile refuge back in the Miocene. So along with Caitlin and some other fine folks, we collected over 500 crocodile teeth that we measured on three different axes. Yeah, over 500. And in particular, we were focused on the site called Hodges Hill, which is right along the Panama Canal, so you're digging fossils with boats going by. It's pretty amazing. And I measured all the teeth on three different axes and gave everyone a shape classification. And so what we found is that the teeth from Hodges Hill are mostly conical-shaped, which indicates a piscivorous or fish-based diet, which is typical of younger crocodilians, as opposed to blunt-shaped teeth, which are typical for small-bodied adults like caimans that tend to eat durophagous or hard objects like turtles. So that indicated that we did have a population of fish-eating crocodilians, and in general, the teeth from Hodges Hill are smaller than other fossil sites, so they probably were younger crocodilians, but they are still bigger than modern yearling alligators, so somewhere in between, kind of a Miocene crocodilian teenage hangout. And it's really interesting because we know that crocodiles have very interesting and diverse nesting and parental care behaviors today, and so it's cool to look back in time and see maybe where and when some of these behaviors were evolving or already established in the fossil record.
Hi, my name is John Graff. I'm a recent graduate from the Southern Methodist University. For my poster, I'm presenting an attempt to do paleoenvironmental reconstructions using dinosaur eggs and paleosol carbonates. Fortunately, they all turned out to be diagenetically altered. So I used the data that I collected to show that there were two different phases of diagenesis that affected our fossil localities, both shallow burial depths, but one within the Vados zone and one within the phreatic zone.
My name is Catherine Early. I am a third-year PhD student in Larry Whitmer's lab at Ohio University, and this is my poster. So for my dissertation, I'm trying to figure out how much we can say about the behavior of birds through their brain endocast. So when you have a fossil skull for a bird, you don't have the brain preserved, but you do have this space that is a pretty faithful representation of the shape of the brain, and so that's the brain endocast. And a lot of times what we like to do as, you know, bird paleontologists is look at the brain, and we know what different structures within the brain in birds are doing to some extent. And we know where they're located underneath the bumps on the endocast. And so we like to look at a bump on the endocast, such as the optic lobe, and say, oh, well, that's enlarged in that group, so they must have had better visual abilities. The problem with doing that, just looking at the endocast and not evaluating the underlying neuroanatomy, is that there's also other structures within, for example, the optic lobe, that aren't necessarily involved in visual behaviors. So we're using this new staining technique. We use Lugol's iodine. We submerge a soft tissue specimen in it for a while, and then we can CT scan it. And Lugol's iodine differentially binds to soft tissues, and so the parts that it binds to more will be more radiopaque because it's a metal, and it binds that way to different neural tissues. It might be due to myelination. The chemistry of the binding isn't totally figured out yet. And so by doing that, we kind of have this like 3D set of almost histological data without actually having to cut up the brains and do the histology work ourselves. So we're looking at using this technique as a substitute for histology and correlating the change in shape and volume of the internal neural structures with the change in shape and surface area of the external structures on the brain endocasts of birds. And so if we can establish correlations between that and then take the correlations further to establish correlations between behaviors and the increase in the size or the shape of a certain structure in an endocast, we'll be able to make those statements that we really like to make with a little bit more soft tissue background. So there's actually a few people in the field working on this right now, like Dr. Amy Balanoff is kind of getting at similar questions. And Ohenya Gold just did PET scanning, so she's doing it from a really functional side of things. So hopefully, all together, we'll get to a more comfortable answer soon.
Hi, I'm John-Paul Hodnett. I am with St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia in the Department of Biology. I'm here actually presenting a new specimen of, we think it's the most complete coelacanth shark ever found worldwide right now. So we found this shark 2 years ago. It's actually turned out to be complete from the tip of the nose to the end of the tail. It's approximately 2.5 meters long. It actually has 2 foot long spines on its dorsal fins, and it may have been the apex predator of the fauna that it was collected from.
Hey, I'm Ben Kligman. I'm a senior at UC Berkeley in the Padian Lab, and I've been interning at Petrified Forest National Park with Bill Parker for the last 2 years, and I've been studying a late Triassic fauna, 221 million years old, that has diverse small tetrapods and fish. And the most significant things we're finding there are chlorodont lepidosauromorphs and sphenodontians and procolophonids, and a lot of these are new taxa. And the chlorodont lepidosauromorphs are especially interesting because they could be the first lizards, if depending on the material we find in the future, because all we have are jaws and they're not diagnostic enough, so we need more cranial elements to be found.
So I'm sitting here now with Dr. William Parker, paleontologist at the Petrified Forest National Park. Hi, Bill. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So the first question we usually ask people is, how did you become a paleontologist?
So I guess my story is a little different than a lot of people who go into paleontology. A lot of people like dinosaurs and things like that when they're a kid, and then they kind of follow that through high school, and then they go to college and all that. And I liked dinosaurs when I was a kid, but I didn't follow it through high school or anything like that. In fact, I went into a completely different career of managing kitchen restaurants for corporations for years, and worked my way up and realized that it's not really what I wanted to do with my life. So I decided to go back to college, and I enrolled in an intro geology class, and I was been kind of interested in that, especially living in Arizona. And we went on a historical geology, we went on a field trip, found my first fossils, and I was absolutely hooked.
So. Cool. So how long have you been at the park now?
I've been at the park since 2001.
Okay. So we're talking about the Petrified Forest, which is in Arizona. And when did the Petrified Forest become a national park?
It was actually originally established in 1906 by Theodore Roosevelt under the Antiquities Act. And it was a national monument at the time. It was elevated to a national park in 1962.
Okay, and how long have paleontologists been interested in the area?
Paleontologists have been kind of working in that area since the 1850s. Some of the first military expeditions came through, and they were the ones who discovered the petrified wood. And they're really intrigued, and some of it went back to the Smithsonian. And it was about that time, really. The first person to actually collect vertebrate fossils in the park was actually the naturalist John Muir.
Oh, wow.
And he did that in 1905, and he handed those fossils off the University of California system, where they caught the attention of other paleontologists, and that pretty much led us where we are today, from the 1920s on.
Cool. Okay, so one of my favorite things about visiting the park is the way you've combined the history of human exploration of the park with the scientific research going on there. So was this a goal that you had in terms of how you were going to convey what's going on there to the public?
my original professional niche, where I was hired in paleontology, I originally worked for the Forest Service, and I was hired to do what's called a paleontological inventory,
okay,
where you go back in and you relocate all these old historic sites, and then you redocument them now using GPS and modern techniques. So I did that for a couple years at the Forest Service, and I was hired by Petrified Forest to do that. But then afterwards, I really started getting into the science side of things and stayed on as a paleontologist. And one of the things I learned from doing these inventories is how important a lot of this historical context is. I'm a firm believer that to take care of something or manage something or learn about something, you have to understand the history of everything that went before you and why we're here. I mean, science is basically just a thing of standing on the shoulders of giants and seeing a little bit farther. If you don't have that context, then you're going to miss out on all that stuff.
Do you have a favorite story that kind of represents the lore surrounding early expeditions at the park?
One of the earliest guys who came out was a guy named Charles Camp. And back then, you know, the main park road that goes through the park wasn't there now, so these guys are basically camping in the middle of nowhere. And Camp was a historian, and he also wrote extensive notes. So it's just a real trip to go back and read his notes and see what he was going through. Everything from rodents running over his head while he was sleeping and him complaining about them getting stuck in his sourdough. He was in the Bay Area, so he loved his sourdough bread, and it was great in the field, to him driving out in the field with a car that he bought and then trying to sell it later but getting less money because he had rolled it like 5 different times.
That's really cool. So the park is known for its fossilized trees. Mm-hmm. What do you know about the environment and how long ago was it a forest?
So actually we know quite a bit. One of the other goals of the Park Service is not only managing the fossils and taking care of them, but we also have the mandate to figure out as much information as we can. And when I first got there, the story was basically that there were some trees and dinosaurs running around. But there's actually a lot more in-depth story than that. There's 20 million years of geological time. So one of the things we've done is try to target all of those intervals and look at how the fossils change through time. But we've also brought in a group of geologists who have looked at, one group from Baylor University has looked at all the paleosalt soils through the entire park, and they've actually figured out temperature, rainfall levels, and all that. So we're putting in a really comprehensive story now of what happened. My goal is to do it almost a million by million year time interval over that 20 million years, which for 220 million years back in time is pretty good resolution. So, and then we can share that with our visitors. I'd say we're almost done with being able to tell a pretty good comprehensive story, and then that'll shape all our future research goals and developing that story more and more.
What sort of animals do you find at the park?
We get everything from invertebrate animals, so things like freshwater mussels and snails, to early dinosaurs, some of the earliest dinosaurs in North America. The most common animals in the park are these superficially crocodile-looking things called phytosaurs. And there's another group of animals that I work in. They're basically big armored-backed animals called aetosaurs. And those guys are all more closely related to crocodiles than dinosaurs, but the whole group's closely related. So they're kind of like dinosaur cousins. And they're our most common fossil in the park, those two groups, as well as these big flat-headed amphibians called the metuosaurs.
Okay.
And
are there any active excavations going on right now?
Yes, so we have our own science program in the park, and we actually excavate pretty much. We can do field work there comfortably March through November. It gets a little cold and rainy and snowy in the winter, but really we can do that, and we do. We go out as much as we can, and we do full excavations. Pretty much every time we go out, we find stuff. Then we also have a lot of research partners. Researchers from the Smithsonian, the Burke Museum, Yale University, LA County Museum, Virginia Tech, just to mention a couple, and we work really closely with them. So we go in the field with them, we share our knowledge of the geology and the fossils, and just get to have a lot of fun.
So, and then where do the fossils go once you've collected them?
There's two places the fossils could end up. If our research partners collect them and they've been designated as a federal repository, the fossils go there. Because the fossils are collected off of federal land in a national park, we don't have any ability to transfer ownership of those fossils. We do not have that authority. So instead, we sign agreements with these agencies to take care of them for us, if that's what they want to do. And they usually do the preparation of them, and they can research them. And, there's a lot of rights they have with the fossils, but the fossils still belong to the federal government. We also have our own collection on site for research and education. And we actually have a building, and we have a curator who takes care of that collection on site.
Okay, and you also have a museum at the park too, right?
We do. We have museum exhibits at the south end that pretty much try to tell the story of the fossils as best we can.
Yeah, and you've recently updated it?
Yeah, so we recently added a room. Again, we have this 20 million years of history, and one of the things I wanted to avoid was people thinking that all 20 million years was exactly the same. So we pretty much give a glimpse of the different changes that occur in these different time periods, and then we focused on one single one to present in this room. What happens if you go back 223 million years in time to what we call the Blue Mesa member? And so we have a big mural that shows what we think the environment would have looked like, all the animals. And then we actually have representative fossils of all the animals that are in the mural to show that these aren't hypothetical animals, they're based on tangible fossils.
So let's talk about your research a little bit. You gave a talk today, and you were talking about aetosaurs, and you used this really interesting phylogenetic method that I've never heard of being used before. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So aetosaurs are interesting animals. They have lots of armor plates to cover the back of the animal, and there's a patterning on the surface of these plates. And interestingly, the pattern is almost like a fingerprint in a way. Every different genus roughly has a different patterning. So you can actually find one of these plates, or even sometimes even a part of a plate, and you can actually identify it down to what genus and sometimes the species that it is. When we start talking about evolutionary relationships in this group, historically, we've used these armor patterns, and there's some aetosaurs that are only known from armor. We have no evidence at all for what the skull or the limbs would have looked like in these animals. So when we drop a family tree of these guys, we're mostly basing it on the armor. But that's a big assumption, that the patterns we see in these armor actually demonstrate the evolutionary history of the group. So one of the things I thought about was, well, what if they didn't have armor? What if they were like a, quote, normal animal and didn't have armor? Because most animals do not. What would their evolutionary records look like? So when I tested that, when I put all the characters together and drew up these trees, one based on armor and the other one based on non-armor, they were very different. They showed very different histories. So that got me interested in potential character conflict. So are those two, since they're telling us two different things, are they actually conflicting with each other and muddling the overall signal? So what I looked at was a technique called partition Bremer support. And this had been used by people to look at conflict when they were comparing molecular data versus morphological data in trees. But nobody had ever applied it for to just looking at a morphological data set. So I compared the armor, the skulls, and then the rest of the postcrania, and looked at what kind of signal those individual partitions were actually providing to the evolutionary tree based on each node or branching event where two taxa occur. So hope it went over well. It seems to have.
So how were the data sets different when you compared them with and without the armor?
You basically get two different trees,
okay.
And they don't show the same clades or evolutionary groups. You don't recover the same ones, and that's problematic.
Yeah.
When they compare molecular and morphological data, there's two camps. There's one group of people who think you should always combine it no matter what, and then there's another group of people who have evidence that, like I said, it muddles the signal. So you never want to combine two totally disparate data sets like that.
Right.
It's a great data analysis tool to look at workings of your evolutionary tree and see what characters of the skeleton are supporting the different animal groupings that you're actually getting, and if you're getting any conflict. Cool. So.
And is can you tell me about other research that's currently going on at the park?
Like I said, we go out and we do field work pretty much year-round. Some of it is just to make sure that we're not losing any fossils to erosion or theft or vandalism. And then we also have our own research program. So we look at everything from early dinosaurs up to pretty much fossil plants. We have pollen. We have all kind of stuff. So we have a dinosaur that's unique to the park called Chindosaurus. And it was originally collected in the mid-80s. And unfortunately, it's just incomplete enough to make some of its evolutionary relationships with other dinosaurs a little ambiguous. So we're working on a project with some South American colleagues to use some other closely related material to try to tease this out. We also have a student who's looking at our microvertebrate record. So, you know, we find the big animals, but when you actually screen all the mud and everything that's surrounding these animals, you'll find the evidence of all the smaller animals. And this had been done in the past, but he's basically developed a new technique that allows him to find much smaller animals that were being missed in some of these studies, and also a way to actually, usually you do this by screen washing. You take a bunch of mud, you put it in a sieve, you wet it, and then you sift through for the little bones. And that can be highly destructive to bones. He's found a way to minimize that damage and allow himself that if a little jaw is in there and it breaks apart, they can actually put it back together and get the whole jaw. So that's a big exciting one. He's finding all kind of new animals that we didn't know about before.
Like what?
Very early things that are probably more related, closely related to modern snakes and lizards. Oh. These things called spinodontians. Mm-hmm. Maybe even some early lizard-like jaws. So, and then if there were some cool fish, we just found the partial jaw of a beakfish called Cerictus.
Ooh.
And it was actually the first record, not only from the park, but from North America.
Wow.
It was thought to be extinct in North America at this time. So he's finding a lot of great stuff.
That's awesome. And you just co-authored a book that came out over the summer called Dawn of the Dinosaurs, the Late Triassic in the American Southwest. Can you tell me a bit about it and what inspired it?
There's just a lot of great research going on right now, I think, in the Late Triassic Southwest U.S. Some of this started in the 80s, and I have some colleagues who have really taken up the torch and are moving forward with all this. Great finds at Ghost Ranch, New Mexico, Petrified Forest, all over. So, but there really wasn't a more layperson treatment of this, just an overarching story of why people are doing this and the stuff that's coming out of it. So I contacted Krista Sadler, who is the main author. She has a background in paleontology, and I think she's a great writer. And we collaborated on this book that pretty much covers research into Chinle Formation historically and current, and Colorado Plateau-wide, so not just at Petrified Forest. And one of the things I wanted to focus on was kind of individual stories with the scientists. So why do these scientists do what they do? So we interviewed several scientists and have them talk about their research in their sidebars. There's also a lot of old paleogeographic reconstructions of what the land would look like. We interviewed the artists. How does he put those together? We even interviewed the artist, have a big feature in there about the artist who created our mural in our exhibit and how he goes about researching and creating a mural like that. So instead of just being a laundry list of these animals lived in the Triassic, it's more of a personal story of the researchers and why they do what they do, woven into just a learning experience about the importance of the Late Triassic and of the area and what all the research means.
What do you think the future of the park is going to be like?
Future of the park. Well, obviously we're going to continue going out. Amazingly enough, after being there 14 years, I really just started to figure out how to actually find really good fossil beds. A lot of our previous work was just getting a lot of the fragments that are on the surface, and we would dig down and we weren't finding much underneath. Well, come to find out, we weren't going down deep enough. When I talk about digging, I don't mean giant holes. I mean digging enough to find through the weathered surface to reach the unweathered surface. And since then, we've been finding lots of bone beds, so large accumulations of bones that then we can systematically collect. And these are really well-preserved bones, and a lot of them are rare animals that we haven't seen before, including the early dinosaur stuff. So I think we're going to start filling in a lot of the blanks, adding a lot of new animals, and getting some, just totally adding to our knowledge. And we're just going to continue doing that, bringing in more research partners, and like to start getting some more students working in the park as well.
Awesome. So. Great. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
No problem. Thank you.
So Julie Meechan is an anatomy professor at Des Moines University in Iowa, and she's joining us here. Hi, Julie.
Welcome.
Hi. So the first question we generally ask on PaleoCast is, how did you become a paleontologist?
That's an interesting question. So I did my undergrad degree at the University of Florida, and they had an ad out for someone to work in the paleontology collection, an undergraduate to work in the paleontology collection. And I was a zoology major. I always thought I wanted to be a vet, but after I did a bunch of internships with vet offices in high school, I realized that they went to school for a long time, paid a lot of money in tuition, and basically ended up doing the same things every day in and out, giving vaccinations, spay and neuter, all day long, every day. And I decided that for the amount of money and time that I would have invested in that just was not for me. And when I saw the ad for the vertebrate paleontologist in the museum, I was like, huh, I've never considered something like that. I bet that would be really neat. And I went in to do an interview, so they chose me to do an interview. And they showed me around the collection, and I was just hooked immediately. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work there. Unfortunately, they didn't hire me.
Oh, no.
But that's okay, because right afterwards, I actually started volunteering in the collection. I took a vertebrate paleontology class with Dave Webb, who's a pretty famous paleontologist, and I really loved it. I loved all the people involved in it. I loved all the specimens I could look at. And so after I did that class with him, I asked him if I could do a research project with him, and he said yes. And so from then on, I was in the vertebrate paleontology range, and I eventually did get hired in that range, in that department. So it all worked out in the end.
That's awesome. That's great. But so you are a vertebrate paleontologist in an anatomy department. So how do the two relate?
Well, that's a good question. I get that a lot. My favorite thing to say is that humans are just another mammal.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of comparative anatomy. That's basically what I focused on for my master's and my PhD work. Was looking at different animals and comparing them and teaching cat anatomy to undergraduates. And so once you know the anatomy of one mammal fairly well, learning the anatomy of another mammal is pretty easy. There's not a lot of differences. There are some. We're just kind of one of those weird mammals that stands upright, and so our muscles and bones look a little bit different, but not a lot. And so it's sort of an easy transition from comparative anatomy to human anatomy.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you have any specific extinct mammals that you work on?
I do. There's a couple of extinct mammals that I'm really fond of. One of them is the saber-toothed cat, Smilodon. And the other one is the dire wolf. So I really love the big carnivores.
Cool.
I did my PhD at UCLA, and so a lot of the work I did was on the Rancho La Brea fauna. And so those are still very near and dear to my heart.
It's the best place.
Yes.
I volunteered there this summer, and that was what got me into paleontology.
That's so great.
Yeah, it just gets you. It really does. So your research focuses on the relationship between morphology and ecology. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, so can you tell me about how you make these connections and how we can learn about ecology from morphology?
Sure. So basically what I do is what's called functional morphology. And that's basically just measuring the osteology of an animal and using comparative measures, ratios, to be able to say, is this animal a runner? Is this animal a jumper? We can usually do that with those comparative ratios and the functional morphology. And what that can tell us basically is how an animal made its living. So if an animal has long limbs, we can say this animal might be a runner. If an animal is short and stocky, we would say, oh, this animal has more power. Maybe it's a climber or a swimmer. And so we can say something about those animals based on that. And so basically what I try to do is I try to use those measurements, look at different animals, compare their ecologies, so how they make their living, and figure out what they were doing in the past.
Cool. And can you give me a specific example of an animal that you're working on and what you've been able to learn about them and their environments?
Sure. So one of the animals, one of the best examples of this that I've done is the saber-toothed Castmylodon. And this was some work I did a while ago. And basically what I learned, which we already knew some of this, but I learned about its forelimbs and about how large they were compared to even other big cats. And other people had speculated or, made some inferences based on their body proportions that Smilodon were not running very much. They were not chasing prey. They were ambushing prey. And basically, my work with arms sort of confirmed that hypothesis that these big cats were hiding, and when they would jump on a prey animal, they would basically surprise it, and they would knock it down with their forearms and use their forearms to hold it down while they made their killing bite.
Wow. Do we see that in any extant cats?
Not to this extent.
Okay.
Some big cats do use their forelimbs a lot, like lions. There's a great video of lions if you go on the site archive. It's like the, free videos of nature and such. You can see a video of a lion attacking buffalo in Africa, and you can see how they use their arms to sort of manipulate their way around the prey, but they don't use them to the same extent that Smilodon did.
Okay, that's really cool. So you do this work at the Natural Trap Cave, is that right? Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Do you use is this a place where you can find evidence to help answer these questions that you're looking at?
Absolutely. So Natural Trap Cave is this really great site. It was originally excavated 30 years ago by Larry Martin and Miles Gilbert. And they probably ran out of money and closed up in 1985 for good. And a collaborator of mine from Australia, Alan Cooper, wanted to go back to Natural Trap Cave to try to get ancient DNA directly from the source.
Mm.
And so I said, sign me up, I want to do the morphology. And together we wrote this proposal that finally got funded at NSF, and we started our Natural Trap Cave journey. And the whole point of doing this project, actually, besides getting ancient DNA, is to sort of reconstruct a late Pleistocene environment to figure out what the environment was like and to figure out how things change in response to climate. For the most part. So we wanted to see how these species change over time related to climate, and Alan Cooper is looking at the ancient DNA and how that changes over time with climate. I'm looking at the morphology and how that changes over time with climate, and I have a whole team assembled that's looking at all sorts of other things. So I'm getting radiocarbon dates to figure out exactly the ages of all the sediments in the cave. I have a collaborator, Penny Higgins, who's looking at the isotopes in the cave, the stable isotopes. So we're going to try to figure out the oxygen isotopes and give us an idea of the temperature of when the animals lived, and the other isotopes would give us an idea of what the animals ate.
Cool.
and then I also have a couple of people working on pollen analyses and phytolith analyses. And my postdoc, Corey Redman, is actually looking at the microfauna of Natural Trap Cave, and along with my collaborator, Jenny McGuire, they're going to try to figure out how the microfauna have changed all the way from the last glacial maximum to about 2,000 years ago. That's the record we have at Natural Trap.
Cool.
We have dated sediments that span that whole gamut.
Wow.
And so this is a really cool project because microfauna can give us so much information about environment.
Yeah.
Because they are sort of they're in their little own microcosm. And so they're much more affected by the local environment than something big that can migrate. And so those microfauna are going to tell us a lot.
That's awesome. So what is it like working in a cave? How difficult is it? And how is it different from conventional field work?
That's a great question. last year was my first year in the cave, 2014, and I was doing all the logistics, and it was a little daunting. I am not a caver.
Right.
I have never rappelled into a cave in my life before last year.
Wow.
So I had no experience. My collaborator, Alan Cooper, is a caver in New Zealand. He does a lot of caving, at least he has in the past. But that's just one person, and we're going to have this whole crew. And it was sort of, I just didn't even know what I was getting myself into. So it turns out that a bunch of local cavers from the local grotto heard about our project and contacted me the week before we went out and said, we just heard about this. This is amazing. People have been trying to get into Natural Trap Cave since 1971, since they locked it. They put a grate on it and locked it. They're like, we will do anything to help you with your project if we can go down. And I said, okay, why don't you guys come out and we'll see how it goes. And we didn't know if these guys were going to be total yahoos or
right.
what. So they all came out, and it turns out that they saved our butts. They basically helped us in every way possible. They helped us rig all our equipment. They helped us get down there safely. They were amazing. And they have just been so professional and wonderful. And so they came back with us last year, and they train people for us, and they oversee the safety, and they do this on a volunteer basis.
That's
so
amazing.
I mean, we had this huge crew of scientists going down there, and now we have a huge crew of cavers helping us. And I have to say, once you get used to rappelling and ascending, it's really not a big deal.
Okay.
It isn't to me anymore. Some of my crew who came out last year are afraid of heights. And this is a 70-foot drop, so
wow.
They kind of got on the rope, and they're like shaking a little bit. And in order to do it, you can't actually see the bottom once you get into the cave. There's this little ledge that you have to stand on, and it's so dark below you. It basically looks like you're stepping off the edge into the abyss when you first go in. And so that's the part, like, some of my colleagues just... You could see them like sitting up there at the ledge, what seemed like, you know, half an hour, probably like 2 minutes,
yeah.
You know, talking themselves into stepping off the edge and thinking to themselves, why am I doing this again? Am I crazy?
Is it worth it? Wow. So it's 70 feet down that you have to rappel into the cave.
Yes.
And what's it like once you get in there? Is it low?
It is beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. It's gigantic. It's a gigantic cavern. There's no sense of claustrophobia at all.
That's good.
Some people were worried about that. Like, do I have to crawl? There's no crawling. It's a huge open cavern. It's at least the size of a football field.
Wow.
There's this huge pit at the bottom where they dug 30 years ago. So basically it's like even deeper than the floor of the cave. There's this big pit, and it's actually very light in there. We thought we were going to need lights, but there's light everywhere, natural light. There's small microcosms down there of rodents. So we actually have deer mice and pack rats living down there.
Uh-huh.
And we get to see them sometimes. They come out for us. We actually had a deer mouse run through the dig one day, and we were like, whoa, what's he doing, bold little guy?
Yeah.
And it's cold. It's about 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
It is very humid, so there's about 90% humidity. And so everybody has to wear layers in there. And by the end of the day, everybody is frozen. And everybody is ready to ascend up into the warmth of the sun.
Yes.
So it is, but it's amazing. And we have so much fun down there.
And can you describe when you get down there, can you just see fossils or?
No, we actually have to dig them up.
Okay.
But the sediment is amazing. It's just really fine silt.
Nice.
So brushes and dental picks and hand trowels, like garden trowels, are all you need.
That's good.
We do have some shovels to move overburden and things like that. Or if we hit a layer that's not fossiliferous, we'll use a shovel. But we try to avoid that because the fossils are pretty much everywhere once you start digging. And so we just use those little fine instruments, and we don't have any issues. It's great.
Yeah, that is great. Have you found anything large enough to create an issue of getting it out and out of the cave?
We have not.
Okay.
So the original excavation found mammoths. We have not found any large pieces of mammoth yet. We found one piece of a mammoth tooth last year, but that was tiny. So nothing that's caused enough logistical nightmare to give us problems. We actually, the cavers are amazing in their ability to rig things up and get them down there. We get these giant Tupperware bins down there full of stuff.
Wow.
So I think even if we did find a mammoth bone, we'd be able to get
they'd
it up.
Figure it out.
Yeah,
somehow.
We'd figure out a way to get it out.
And then where are you taking the fossils once you're getting them up out of the cave?
The 2014 specimens went to Kansas, which is where all the original specimens went from the original excavation. And then everything from now on is going to go to the University of Wyoming.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so what have you learned so far from this cave deposit?
What have we learned so far? Well, we've learned a little bit. We haven't learned a ton yet. We just haven't done a lot of analyses. I've been working on the wolves of Natural Trap, and I'm not going to give the game away yet because I'm submitting a paper about it, but they're different.
Okay.
Well, so they're really cool, and they're really different. And so everybody can keep their eye out for that.
Yeah, definitely. We'd love to have you back on once the paper comes out.
All
you
right.
can tell us all about it.
So. All right. And the other thing we've learned is that we've got an amazing record. I mean, they didn't do serial radiocarbon dating in the past. I don't know what technique they used in order to pick their specimens to date. But we have basically done a serial dating regime so far, where we take some specimens from each level to try to give an idea of what the stratigraphy is like and how old it is. And we're even fine-tuning that more this year. And basically what we've found is that, you know, there's this amazing record from the last glacial maximum all the way to 2,000 years ago, which is, you know, pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And when people hear that, they're always like, oh my God, there's so much potential there. And I'm like, yes, I know, I'm so excited. So that's one thing we've learned. We've also actually learned last year that there may be other pits in the cave that we didn't know about, that nobody knew about. So the main hole is about 15 feet in diameter, and it's the one that's directly under, the main pit is the one directly under that hole, but it looks like there's a couple of solution cones that may have been open to the surface many moons ago that have closed up since. And so we started digging some test pits underneath those cones, and we haven't gotten very deep yet, but that's something that we're going to really sort of continue to explore a little bit more next year.
That's great. So this is a long-term project then?
This is hopefully a long-term project. We have one more year of funding from NSF, but we probably have enough. We were pretty frugal this year.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be able to stretch that probably for one more field season. And then I hope with a supplemental grant of some sort, it doesn't have to be very large, we can extend that to at least one more field season. So I'm hoping that we have three more years of digging.
That's great.
That's my optimistic outlook.
Yeah. And is there somewhere that that people can go to find out more information about the site that you're working at?
There's a lot of stuff in the press. There's a lot of Associated Press articles that came out about it. So if you Google Natural Trap Cave, there should be several things online.
Okay.
There's old publications from the 70s and 80s that came out on it, but they're all in sort of obscure journals that are really hard to find.
Right.
So I'd love to direct people that away, but you know, I'm afraid that it's going to be almost impossible to find those articles. You might be able to find one or two of the more popular ones online.
Mm-hmm.
But I think online you could find a lot of stuff just from the press coverage that we have.
Awesome. And we'll put some stuff up on the website. It'll go along with this recording so that you can learn a little bit more about Julie and her work at the Natural Trap site. So thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Caitlin. It's good to talk to you.